Well, talk about the Bible lands being a land of promise, yet the land of promise where we're studying right now is now becoming a land of trial, a land of testing, and a land that has to be maintained. And that's something that they don't do very good at, the children of Israel. And I want to talk about more about the fact that, if anything, the Old Testament proves God fulfilled His promises. So let's just do something real quick. Look at Joshua 21, and I'm going to try to get back on track. I'll tell you the difficulty with Bible geography for me is getting too specific, wanting to talk maybe too specifically about one city, and that became an issue for me last Sunday. But we're going to do something again a little bit more broader this evening that I think began to make more sense to me this week as I was reflecting. So I want to do that. So let's talk about this, and I'm going to talk more about Moab a little bit specifically because this ties into the scheme of redemption very clearly. And then eventually we're going to get to the Amalekites again. We've already talked about some of these people, but we're going to get to the Amalekites again and start talking about what will lead up to the divided kingdom. And that's my goal tonight. Let's try to do that. But look at Joshua 21 and notice just again the fulfillment of God's promise and of giving the land to the children of Israel. The land was again given to them. And so in Joshua 21, verse 13 and following, if you'll remember here, Joshua 21, verse 13 and following, they gave to the children of Aaron, the priest, Hebron with her suburbs to be a city of refuge for the slayer. And throughout this text, you have the fulfilling of God's promises. Look at verse 43 when you get to the end of this text. And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest round about according to all that he sware unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. There failed not aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. One of the things that some scholars say about this text is this might be more of an ellipsis text, wherein that the inspired writer is writing about something that happened after the fact, and yet this particular time it had not been completely fulfilled as far as like the conquering of it. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that sometimes scholars say a lot of things that you have to just take with a grain of salt, so to speak. I think that the land had been given to them. We understand that they had not conquered it all completely, but again, they, upon God's promise, God had fulfilled his promise in putting them and getting them to the land. What I want to remind you of, though, is the constant conditions that go back to the books of Moses. Look at Leviticus chapter 26, for example, and remember, even before they had gotten to the land, there is abundance in information reminding them that they would have to maintain this land. Look at Leviticus 26, verse 1 and following. And what I'm going to try to do here is make some text harmonize. Look at verse 1. And this is, again, the organization of the nation here before they had even gotten and left Mount Sinai. They're receiving the law here. And here at the foot of Mount Sinai, where Moses was up in the mountain 40 days, of course, 40 nights, receiving the law and then revealing the law to them, and then they would depart. This was spoken to them. Ye shall make ye no idols, nor graven images, neither rear you up a standing image, neither shall ye set up any image of stone in your land to bow down unto it, for I am the Lord your God. Ye shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, Then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase. What land is he talking about there? Yeah, the promised land that they would receive. The land would yield. And so you can read through the conditions of Leviticus 26 very clearly. Look at verse 6. And I will give peace in the land. Now, how much peace occurs in the land while they are in the land, possessing the land, after they fight in the days of Joshua and get to the book of Judges? How much peace do they really enjoy in the land? Okay, that's right. And so just because God fulfilled his promise and he gave them the land doesn't mean that they fulfilled theirs most of the time. So, yes, and notice here again, verse 7, and ye shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before by the sword. And he talks about the wars and how they would be victorious. Look at verse 11 again. We talk about the tabernacle being set up at Gilgal. It's eventually set up in Gibeah, I believe, if I remember correctly, where Saul is from, King Saul. And it stays there for a while until Solomon builds the temple in Jerusalem, the city, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. So notice again here, I will set the tabernacle among you, my soul shall not abhor you. At this time, the city of Jerusalem had not been chosen where the temple would be built, but again, he's talking about the land. But then notice very quickly how he reminds them, I will be your God and walk among you, and you shall be my people, verse 12. I am the Lord your God, verse 13, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that ye should not be their bondmen, and I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you go upright. But if ye will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, now notice the transition. You see the transition right there in verse 14, and he starts to speak of the conditional relationship in the land. He says, and if ye shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhor my judgments, so that ye will not do all my commandments, but that ye break my covenant, I will also do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, the burning of you, and shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and ye shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. And look at verse 19, a principle here that seems to be a major problem all the time. And I will break the pride of your power. Pride goeth before what? That's right. And pride is, again, something that gets a lot of people in trouble. I had a sister in Christ, a faithful sister, struggled because her mother, who had taught her the Bible all her life, read the Bible to her, knew the Bible back, but came to a conclusion that was false later in her life, and coincidentally died without ever repenting. But she took the position that Jesus, the Son of God, the Lord, was lower than the Father, that he was not equal or eternal. And she drew that conclusion. Well, talking about pride, this young lady told me, she said, I can't imagine my mom, number one, being wrong, because she knows that Bible. And she said, number two, I cannot imagine how she would come to a faulty conclusion, but yet I know everybody else is saying she's false. She's false. And she was false. She said, I don't understand. You know, and so I got thinking about that, and I quoted 1 John 2, and I said, the pride of life is a dangerous sin. The pride of life. You know, we're talking about the lust of the flesh and lust of the eyes, but then also John says the pride of life. Okay? Well, what do you mean? My mom's not proud. She's humble. I said, she's got some type of an academic pride. She studied herself into a false conclusion. That's pride. That's not allowing her to repent. So you think about pride getting people in trouble. People get set up on a position and it becomes an issue of pride, and it's not really an issue of evidence. She was disproven over and over again by being shown scripture that contradicted that position. But nonetheless, she would not relent. So pride gets us in trouble, gets brethren in trouble. Okay, and we sometimes, well, I'm not a fornicator, but boy, I sure am arrogant. I'm proud. You see what I'm saying? God says I'll break that pride. So again, I want to remind you of these passages in the Old Testament. And this is, again, an entire text talking about these conditions. Now, what's interesting to me, and this is where I want to try to talk about the situations in Moab, Ramah, and Jerusalem, and do this in a systematic way. Moab is an interesting text or location because during the days of the judges, Ruth is the revelation that we're talking about now. We've talked about the Philistines a little bit, and I don't know, again, how detailed I can go back into some of that without getting on a snare. But when you get to the book of Ruth, one of the challenges is, and remember, they're in the land of promise, but they're all messed up. They're not fighting like they're supposed to be fighting. God's raising up judges. And if you'll notice in verse 1 of Ruth chapter 1, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. Here's a challenge, a test. Maybe Leviticus 26 and the famine and the pestilence and the various things God warned them about is what's taking place here. God's providence being held back because they're not being faithful in the land. Like God said, they must be faithful in the land. Well, what then is the book of Ruth all about in the midst of this geographical mess? Well, it becomes a story of redemption. And it's not about really God's people. It's about God getting Naomi back through terrible things that happen. She loses her children, her sons, and her husband where? In Moab. And one of her sons marries what kind of a woman? Ruth, a Moabitish woman. And Ruth, a Moabitish woman, becomes what? Look at the end of the book of Ruth. An ancestor of Jesus. Now, who in the world can work that out but God? You see, the land of promise is now a great challenge to the people. And it's God, if you analyze this, through His providence and His scheme of redemption, working out this issue. Look at Ruth chapter 4. As it closes out, and we don't have time to go into all the book. And Ruth, of course, has a child through Boaz, and of course, the story of the kindred redeemer, a wonderful principle that's, again, a part of the law of Moses, not a part of the new covenant. And Naomi, in verse 16, took the child and laid it in her bosom, became nurse unto it, and the woman, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi." And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. And isn't that interesting? And so now you have a genealogy account that then just ties this all together and it shows God working out their problems. But it doesn't stop there. As I thought about again where we were, you can kind of see where Moab is here on this map. During the time of Ruth, it's over here. The land of promise is primarily over here. And they wandered over there to try to get away from the famine, and she runs into some hard times, but God works it out. So you have these cities here and these locations. I located on this map for you Bethlehem, or I just put the picture on there for you, Jerusalem, to show proximity, and Ramah. Ramah becomes an interesting city because of the place where God's people first cry out for a king. You remember in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 4 through 5, we talked about this Sunday, I believe. This is the location where they cry out for a king. And remember, this was predicted in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy 17. They'd ask for a king. But I'm just reminding you of the conditions here. The king will be given. And his name will be Saul. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about Saul and some of the problems with Saul and the Amalekites here in 1 Samuel 15 in just a moment if I get there. But in this location, they reject God. But here's what I want to do. I want to look at 2 Kings chapter 7 for a moment. Let's try to fast forward and make a little bit of history tie all together. And I want you to notice why when we get to the end of this, God will ultimately sell them into captivity. Allow the Assyrians to take them. Remember in 2 Kings chapter 7, look at verse number 7. And here's a terrible text, but one that tells us what their problems were. In the land where they were not being very good stewards. 2 Kings 7:7. Wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their donkeys and even the camp as it was and fled for their life. And when these lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into the tent. Let me see here. I think I'm in the right place. I say this and then I start. Why am I not finding this? Let's see if it's chapter 17. Let me look at chapter 17. I know it's in 2 Kings. Yeah, it is chapter 17. See, 17:7. All right. Yeah, look at verse 7 of chapter 17. I knew that didn't sound right. All right, 2 Kings 17, verse 7. All right, here it is. Okay. All right, it's fixed to be sold into captivity. Assyrians involved here and so forth. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, which had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods. Now, every time I read that, I tell myself, I'm going to go back and count the number of times in the Old Testament God reminds his people of what he did getting them out of Egypt. That's their story of redemption in the Old Testament. What they forgot was is that they were a people that were to bring forth a Messiah, the Christ, and they would crucify him eventually. But here again, he reminds them of that great delivery. And look at verse 8. And walk in the statutes of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel, which they had made. Now notice again, the Lord, who cast this stuff out? Okay? One of the things people don't understand about redemption or salvation is simply there's two parts. There's two parts always, or two places involved here, two things involved here, God's part and man's part. But it's always God who does the delivering. You get that? It's always God that remits sins. You cannot remit your own sins. Okay? Bible says, someone says, well, the Bible says, save yourself from this untoward generation. Well, in the sense of what? Not that you can save yourself from your sins, but that you must be obedient. Okay? There shouldn't be any confusion. I really struggle with the mindset that is so, I think, manipulative of the once saved, always saved mindset. Because it is a mindset of, in and of itself, one that says you can earn your own salvation even though they say that they deny it. Because they say you don't have to do anything. And if you don't have to do anything, then that means that it's owed to you. It's owed to you. It's the only other conclusion they can draw. But they don't like to say that either. So again, they really struggle with this, but from the Old to the New Testament, God has his part. Anyway, it's just a little side thought. So God delivered them, but watch the specifics of what they will do in the land. And this is toward the end of their stay in the land, before they are sold into captivity and before Ezra, Nehemiah, and those books come into place. So they did that which was evil in verse number 9. They did secretly those things that were not right against the Lord their God. What does that say about trying to hide or doing things that people don't see in your little private places and so forth? God still sees it. Okay, so again, they could not hide from him. They built high places and offered sacrifices. Verse 10, they set up images and groves in every high hill and under every green tree. And you read through this text all the way down to about verse 18. Look at verse 18. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only. And we're going to try to get to this text where we talk about the divided kingdom tonight. And what, again, more challenges lead up to this apostasy, constant apostasy. I've made mention of this in this class before. When archaeologists dig in this part of the world, one of the things they find over and over again, and if you keep reading through 2 Kings 17, it talks about them serving Baal, or Baal, the false god, and the goddess, Ashtaroth. And they find these little idols, little clay idols, all the time. They find it more than they do potsherds. And this is a indication of what kind of a people were in this land. So what do you think, again, archaeologists and people say when they find all this and then they're looking at the Bible and they're talking about these so-called holy rollers, self-righteous people that are supposed to be Jews? They say, well, these were nothing but a bunch of idolaters. And you know what? They're true. They're right. But, again, the emphasis isn't upon the idolatry as much as it is the few there be, or the scheme of redemption with God bringing out the good with the bad always, with like these little books like Ruth. Getting them out of Moab, getting them back in the land, getting them straightened out. And so, as you kind of consider this land, it's a great land of challenge. We were talking about this last Sunday, and this was just kind of trying to constantly remind us of the things that are going on in this particular land. And I don't know if this thought is interesting to you, but as today I was taking some notes and thinking about some of this, I thought that this was interesting. Now I want you to think about this. The land of Palestine, the promised land, the land that it is now, has it ever been a mighty center location of a major empire in the history of the world? You got to think about that question. Even before God's people conquered it, God's people took it from what other people? Who were they called? You remember they were called the Canaanites. And the Canaanites were broken up into different groups like Philistines and Amalekites and Hittites and various other groups. And it was almost like little tribal warfare going on all the time in this particular land. But one of the things that I notice is that this land has never been, until God put Israel in that land, a land that was united. Now think about it. You had your Egyptian empire, dynasties and so forth, that were world dominant and powerful. They had their centralized cities and locations. You eventually get into the Assyrians, Damascus, and various other places, which are hubs of empire unity or conquering forces. You get your Babylonians, you get your Persians, and they have centralized locations where they are, in some sense, united, a force to be contended with. God puts Israel in this little landmass in the middle of all this, and they do what during their stay? Here's another question just to think about, even to this day, and this is a map, as I pointed out last week, of kind of the current situation. It's still contested. This is the 1949 armistice line right here after World War II. They put them back over there, the Jews, because of the Holocaust and all that. And you still got these contested little spots here. This right here, this little circle right here, the old city. This is the Temple Mount. That's not really controlled by them. That's controlled by the Muslims now. Okay? Do you see right now today, and this is not exactly accurate today, but do you see over here in Israel a mighty force to be contended with, a united location, a major country? I mean, if it wasn't for NATO or it wasn't for America really funding a lot of what goes on in Israel, modern day Israel, would they really have the power that they have to even really defend? I know they got nuclear bombs and all that. I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that this land, even to this day, is not a united place. It's a hotly divided, hotly contested place. And it always has been, in one sense. It never does become the long-standing empire. Now, here's the last thought. Maybe this, again, is a waste of your time. It never has been, in one sense. Yes, God gave them the land. Yes, God fulfilled His promises. Yes, God brought forth the Messiah, born of a virgin, in Bethlehem, not in Jerusalem, as the Mormons say. Yes, God got that thing straightened out, if you will, but then God says what? He says what to the apostles and the Jews? Your house is left unto you desolate. Matthew 24. And He speaks of the fact that this land's going to be destroyed again and again, but ultimately through the Romans. But what mighty nation or power ever sets a headquarters up in this land? Romans? Even after the Catholics evolve, they try to kind of maintain Jerusalem a little bit and build the Holy Roman Empire. They don't last there. They end up going over to Alexandria for a short time and then Constantinople. And that doesn't last because they keep getting run out of Dodge by the Arabs or the Muslims. And they end up finally over in Rome in a little bitty old boot-shaped country called Italy. But you still got this little old Holy Land over here that's still a hotly contested, divided piece of property. And the premillennialists today, the premillennialists say what about this land right here today? Thousand-year reign, people. God's going to come back and set up, and Jesus is going to reign from Jerusalem. That place has never been a place of peace. God fulfilled His promises in Jerusalem through the prophets as He said He would. And I would say in one sense, it's not to say that there aren't people there that don't need to be converted, but I would say in one sense He got out of there. He told the gospel to do what? He told the apostles to do what with the gospel? Go into all the world. So there's your geography lesson. I don't know, maybe that's too broad for you. But I thought about that, and I thought about how that land has never been a land of peace. The Prince of Peace was born over there. The Redeemer of the world came out of that area, but he didn't stay there either. Where'd he go? He went back home. And He said to the apostles, where I go to prepare a place for you. So, it's amazing to me the way people think that Jehovah's Witness, everybody, they want to go back over. That land has been, and the time they spend in their life, the energy they give to that type of thinking. You can think about that. I don't know if, again, that's something interesting, but to me, I kind of tie that in. So, it's a Bible geography. So, here you have, again, as we looked at last Sunday, a sketching of the Solomonic Temple up here. There's the temple on the Temple Mount. This was Solomon's house or palace that was built. You've got the old walls, the old city. That's a rendition of the idea of what it likely looked like as it was being set up. Again, look at 2 Samuel chapter 5 now for a moment. And notice, it's in verse 5. I'm going to read verses 1 and following to pick up the context. But I want you to notice verse 5 and verse 6 here in particular. This is when God picks, this city here, Jerusalem. This is after King Saul. Remember, King Saul, he wasn't given this location. Verse number 1, then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron, and spake, saying, behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, thou wast he that leddest out and broughtest in Israel. And the Lord said to thee, thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be a captain over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron. And King David made a league with them in Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel officially. And David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. If there was ever a time of peace, if there was ever a time of great unity in the land of promise, the land of Israel, when was it? And here's another question. How long does it last? That's exactly what my thinking is. And I think it's a good point to consider. Here, David reigns for 40 years, but like Dennis says, how many years of that 40 years was it really united? How many problems does David have in his own household, in his own sons and daughters, son rising up trying to take the kingdom away from him? And because of whose sins? All right, and then, like you said, the apex, if you will, the high point of the kingdom is with Solomon. How long does Solomon reign? So you might be able to say, if you're being general, generic, about 40 years maybe, but then what kind of a person is Solomon? He turns to idols. And so, and women and concubines and all the things that God said don't do. Now that's your king and you live in that land, how easy is it to be united? Brethren, y'all may think I'm crazy. But I can still remember when old Bill Clinton looked into the camera and said about that woman, I did not, and you remember the rest. And I can also remember when he said, it depends upon what your definition of the word it is, I-T. And I can remember when that happened, all the people being united. Oh, Bill, he is such an honest man. No. If you were in Arkansas, you had about 50% of it. Well, you know, he's going to bring good things to Arkansas. He's going to really build our economy. We got to stand behind old Bill. And then the rest of them that had a brain said, this guy is terrible, immoral, and they were talking about the right things, how it affected the kids in school. The children who were taught to look up to presidents and dignitaries and people and have respect, as the Bible teaches, by the way. But this is your president. And it's being broadcast all over the news. It didn't cause much harmony. And since then, I can't think of much harmony that's being promoted from the head down. So again, you have to think about some of these things. And again, you can get a little bit too detailed maybe in that because of which Roman Empire, going back to those days, were they ever really fully behind the Roman empires, emperors. So, again, you have to be careful some of that thinking. So, here's just a picture of kind of the temple as it would develop. Look at 2 Kings chapter 5 again as I cut short the passage here. Look at verse 5. So in Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. Location's Hebron at that point. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spake unto David, saying, except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither, thinking David cannot come in hither. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, another name for Jerusalem, the same is the city of David. So, interesting that you get to, you backtrack, or you go to a, my brain is really shorting out. 1 Kings chapter 5. Yes. 1 Kings chapter 5, after David's reign, and you'll see where the temple is being prepared, as we pointed out. And David wasn't allowed to build the temple. In 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7, the temple is being built. The plan and the details are laid out. In chapter 7, It's where he starts to build his own house, spends 13 years, and he finishes that house. And there was a lot of building and construction going on. But then as you keep moving forward towards the end of Solomon's reign and Solomon's affairs and so forth, and turning away from the Lord, the divided kingdom and the revolt in 1 Kings chapter 12 between Jeroboam and Rehoboam takes place. And I'm telling you, as you look at the clock and the calendar, how long have they been over here and been at peace and enjoyed the unity that God said that they could have? So what I want to do going forward here, trying to set this up a little bit more maybe principled, when you think about this land, it's a land of trial and testing, and really God's providence being tried and proven. Because in the end of this story, after they go into captivity, then what will happen again? They're going to come out of captivity for 70 years. And here's something to think about. When they go into captivity, the end of 2 Kings, they have that temple destroyed. That temple, the walls, isn't rebuilt until what days? Yeah. Ezra, Nehemiah. And then it's not really ever completed until Herod comes around. During the, right before the first century. Before Jesus is born, Herod goes in there and he rebuilds. But here's something else to remember. You remember all the artifacts, all the things they were told to build in the book of Exodus? Back there in the wilderness at Mount Sinai, the Ark of the Covenant, the brazen laver, and all these things they were to wash with. Remember all those things, the golden lampstand and so forth? Do you know that there are still rock carvings, reliefs of where the Babylonians destroyed them and took all of those artifacts, and there's carvings of this, of them carrying and hauling this stuff off to Babylon. The Bible talks about that, the end of 2 Kings. And did you know that that stuff is never seen again? It's never known to come back. And where did God's presence dwell? The Ark of the Covenant was the representation of God's presence. And you think about that as you consider again this land of promise. Whatever happened to that Ark of the Covenant, it didn't matter in one sense, because guess what? A few hundred years down the road here, Jesus is coming. And God's presence will no longer be represented by a box or a piece of material dirt or land, but by a person in the body of Jesus Christ. And so that's God's presence. And who recognizes him even truly to this day? Who really recognizes Jesus for who he really is and what he represented even to this day? So you can think about that maybe as it applies to the land of promise. Now I need to talk about Megiddo. I almost skipped over this, but then I got to thinking about how important this little valley is. Anybody ever heard of Megiddo or the Valley of Jezreel? Anybody know what the premillennialists say is going to happen over there? You ever heard of Armageddon? Okay, Armageddon is a word that's found in the book of Revelation one time, and it's actually two words. It's Har, meaning mountains, Megiddo, which is Megiddo, the Valley of Jezreel, as it's also referred to. And because of a spiritual application in reference to a battle, a spiritual battle, in the Battle of Armageddon is thought about. And so the premillennialists say in this Valley of Megiddo, this major battle of all the world is going to take place in that right there, Jezreel Valley. I thought that was a pretty good picture. Kind of gives you a good perspective. You can kind of see the Mediterranean Sea, of course, right there. Carmel Mountains, Mount Carmel, Megiddo Valley or Jezreel Valley. And then you've got the Jordan River back here, Dead Sea's up here, Sea of Galilee over here. And, of course, you've got to really think, that's a satellite type of picture. But according to the premillennialists and their misinterpretation of the book of Revelation, right there in that valley is where Satan and all of his warriors are going to battle, the last battle. Jesus is going to come in and battle with all of his people. There's going to be this world battle that's going to take place right there, and of course we're going to win. And then Jesus is going to go set up his throne in Jerusalem. Okay, he's going to reign. He's going to rule finally, because he's not reigning and ruling right now. But the Valley of Megiddo is mentioned in several locations, and this goes back to the book of Judges. There's a battle that takes place with Deborah, you may remember, in Judges chapter 5, verses 15 through 20. There's a battle that takes place, I believe it's in 2 Kings 22 or 23, with Josiah, I believe, with one of the pharaohs, and it takes place in the Valley of Jezreel. A lot of battles take place here. A lot of fighting, a lot of history. Pretty neat place. But what's, again, interesting is when you get to the book of Revelation, all of a sudden this becomes the final place of battling. And I wanted to kind of point that out. There's the fertile kind of valley, as it may look kind of today, similar, a lot of farming going on. That used to be a lot of battling going on there. There's a little place called Megiddo. But this is the Jezreel Valley, the Valley of Megiddo. And so if you think about Deborah and some of the battles she fought, some of the kings fought with the Egyptians, that's the location of that. And it's referenced in the Bible several times, but it takes on just a spiritual application in the book of Revelation, not a literal application. I might stop. I didn't realize my time was getting out. I want to get to the Amalekites and King Saul and talk about the divided kingdom, hopefully Sunday morning, right? Sunday morning. And we will hopefully get through the Old Testament portion of this study. Any comments or questions? Okay. Thanks for your attention.